All right, welcome everybody to our first session of the 2017 calendar year. It's a very exciting session on football poetry. We haven't done much with literature, and I think it was high time that we addressed that. And we're very fortunate that one of our stalwart members, Dr. David Kilpatrick, has published a book of poetry based on the World Cup of 2014 in Brazil. And for those of you who don't know David, he teaches courses in English, philosophy, and sports management at Mercy College, where he's been since 1998. He has a PhD from SUNY Binghamton and is the author of Writing with Blood, The Sacrificial Dramatist as Tragic Man, published in 2011, and the book we're reading today, a collection of poems entitled Obrigado, a football epic. He has spoken on sports studies and modernism and theory of criticism internationally and regularly appears on global radio and TV networks, including BBC World Service and One World Sports. So it's a great pleasure to welcome our colleague and dear friend David to the show. Take it away, David.
Well, I can't thank you enough. A profound honor to have a session of Football Scholars Forum dedicated to this work. This was kind of a crazy idea that popped into my head a few years ago when I was teaching and doing a lot of things that kind of brought the worlds of poetry and football together for me. And more than anything, I just felt like no one had ever done this before and that it needed to be done. And that sense of urgency or necessity didn't leave me and kind of, took over my summer a couple years ago. And that's what you have in front of you, this collection of poems or one poem, depending on your perspective, whether it's one work or 65 works. I'll leave that up to you. And what's the real form of it, whether it's in the book or the recording or any live performances of it. Those are just kind of some of the questions that I was wrestling with in terms of the ephemeral nature of the sporting event and the memorializing of sport events in poetry and other forms of artistic expression. So I was just trying to tease out all those different issues that meant so much to me. And hopefully what passed through is something you'll all find worthwhile.
Great. Thanks, David. We can have questions lining up in chat, as we always do. And we also have the hashtag, hashtag FSF Obrigado.
So who'd like to go first?
I'll just allow a moment for anybody to raise their hand. And if not, we have some questions in the bank people who couldn't make it. Great. Go ahead, Daniel.
Did you see the chat? Because I also wrote on the chat.
Yes.
It works, right?
Yes.
Hi, David. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm very well. And I already tweeted my question since I'm very enthusiastic about you, since you are one of the few Americans who shares my passion for handball. And not everybody might know that David almost made it to the Olympics in 1984 as a U.S. handball goalkeeper. So tell us about why did you not write poems on handball? Why did you write on football?
Well, that's a question I didn't expect. I have to. I was actually really involved with team handball from 1984 and 85. It wasn't the 84 Olympics that I was trying to earn a place on. It would have been for the 88 team. That was kind of the dream, 88 and 92. Didn't happen. But that was, I got involved in the Olympic system through a program New York State used to have called the Empire State Games. And in 1983, as a freshman in high school, I was cocky enough to try out for the soccer team. And New York State was broken into different regions. And not realizing that, I guess I would have been 13 years old, that most people were going into their senior year that made the team. I made it through the first two cuts, and a lifelong striker, they kept making me play midfield in the tryouts, but I was absolutely heartbroken and devastated not to have made the final cut. So I kind of vowed that I was going to make it to the Empire State Games and kind of resigned by 1984 to think I wasn't going to make the U.S. national team in soccer. So I really committed myself to team handball in of all positions as a goalkeeper. Those of you who know my height probably understand why I ended up not making it to the national team. My height ultimately was one of the reasons Laszlo Udarek, who is the national team coach, said I'd never make it. But that dream was crushed sometime in 1985. And yeah, I saw your tweet, and it's funny because I guess I realized around the time I wasn't going to make the final national team in team handball, that was around the time I started writing poetry in 1985. So maybe there's a link there between handball and the poetry I never realized.
And if I may ask a follow-up question, I also tweeted, you have a German line in the poem on the final. How did you come up with this? Was this Google Translator or it's slightly incorrect, the grammatic, but one understands what you mean. So how did you come up with that line?
The Diese neue deutsche Fußball, you mean, yeah? That line. I think with this poem, there's a kind of a cosmopolitan gesture that is probably terribly naive and comes across like a over-exuberant, perhaps slightly intoxicated tourist at times. And it's certainly a linguistic high-wire act that I'm trying to pull off with the whole piece. Little broken bits of language, trying to encounter the other in their own language, that type of thing. And the phrase that just came to me, and that poem, some of these poems were written during the match, some of these poems were written after a match, some a blend. That particular line was actually written sometime in the first half. And I was just trying, for some reason, this new German football didn't seem right. So the phrase "Diese neue deutsche Fußball" is what came through. But like a lot of other different, whether it's a word or a phrase in different languages, I am kind of exposing myself there too in terms of errors and mistakes. But that's part of the fun of it, I guess.
Blitzkrieg. I usually just know from the British press. Because they are not very German friendly usually when it comes to football.
Well, I think that was the thing that really, by the time we got to the final, I mean, there was the one game where they, in the opening round, where they played to a draw, but it was such a hot day, and I think we forget how hot and intemperate it was. By the time they got to the final, I really felt like Germany had redefined itself as a football nation. And the way they were playing football was something that I just found really inspirational. And so I was trying to capture the sense of a new German football.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks, Daniel. We have a hand raised from Laurent.
Hey, everyone. It's great to be in the conversation. I guess I had two questions. I really enjoyed the poetry. One was... just whether there were other models, like literary models. There's obviously, I imagine you teach a number of them, but so many different kind of genres of poetry recounting historical events or celebrating heroes. And I was just kind of curious. I mean, I had some ideas as I was reading, but I was just kind of curious if you had, models that had written about other things other than sports that you were drawing on. And then I've been reading recently The Home and Away, the letters between Nausgaard and Ekelund. I don't know if you've read that at all. Written during the 2014 World Cup, and especially Ekelund's letters back from Brazil just kind of reminded me. It was kind of just an interesting point that, like, we have your poetry work, and then there's this kind of, I guess, epistolary genre, let's say, of football writing that's also coming out at the same time. So it's just kind of interesting to see people experimenting with these different forms. now, you know, as we try to find new ways to write about the sport. So.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Nosgaard Ekelund letters. I just picked it up in Brooklyn Sunday. I hadn't heard of it, and I just saw it in a bookshop, and I'm really enjoying it. And it's funny you say that. Carl Ove has a line very early in it where he compares his friend going to Brazil and kissing the ground and having this very romantic engagement with mm-hmm. it. Ove, on the contrary, identifies not with Brazil but Argentina, and right. the mediated experience of watching at home on his couch.
Uh-huh. And falling asleep. And he always falls asleep during the games also. Which yeah. is-
well, yeah, I don't know if you picked it up, but that actually happens to me at one poem very right. early here, where I say I'd prefer to dream. I think it must have been an Australia game. yeah, it's the fifth poem, Chile versus Australia. It ends with a phrase, I just as soon shut my eyes and dream of masters on the ball. that tension, and that was the thing too with this project. I had so many friends in Brazil, as I'm sure all of you did. Some of you on the call, I'm assuming, may have been there. And it was a choice to commit to this project. Obviously, I had to be able to take in all 64 matches. I really had to stay glued to, if not a television set, then at least my phone, my iPhone, and watching games. So there was that whole tension, but unlike what's said by Ove in the Nosgaard Ekelund book, I didn't feel that kind of Apollinian detachment because of the mediated sense of it. I mean, I wasn't drinking beer at the Budweiser bar, but you know, I still felt very much immersed in the experience. And I suppose that's my family too. I mean, I was watching every game with my family, my son, my daughter, my wife, and when I could with friends, but I did have to miss out on a lot of the social things, you know, the massive, massive gatherings we had here in New York and elsewhere, you know, in public squares and beer gardens and things like that. I did miss out on that because I wanted to make sure if a line came for a poem, I'd be able to sit down and read it without getting a beer splashed in my face. I don't know if that answered your question, but I was so surprised to find this Nosgaard and Ekelund book. I hadn't heard anything of it, so I was so delighted to discover it Sunday, and I'm glad you discovered it as well.
Right.
Oh, yeah, in terms of different writers and genres then, you know, I think a lot of the reason this book came about was I was teaching a grad course in sport literature while I was teaching an undergraduate course in classical literature.
Mm.
And George Plimpton has the famous, now I think obviously outdated notion that the smaller the ball, the better the literature. But he wrote that before Hornby, well before Hornby came out with Fever Pitch. And it happened in terms of sport lit from the 90s on. And, you know, I'm hoping most of you, if not all of you, have the collection, The Global Game, edited by John Turnbull, Tom mm-hmm. Sepp, and Alon Rapp, which is just a lovely, lovely collection. And I have to say, I really miss that website that John Turnbull used to run, the Global Game website. So there's lots of people writing in various genres on football in very different ways. But I was really kind of struck while I was teaching sport literature and classical literature on how it could connect and the idea of this moment in time. One thing in particular I was really obsessed with throughout this was just the idea of the psychic energy concentrated around the globe
mm-hmm.
on events and kind of trying to tap into that and to have something come out of that. Feeling all along that somewhere somebody's doing this too. And I think that's the thing. There's so many poems out there, I'm sure, that we'll never see that are generated by people either while it was going on or many, many years to come
mm-hmm.
about this. But I really think we play with that cliche of playing poetically or, oh, that was an epic match and things like that. And so I really wanted to try to test that. I mean, is it, as a professor of literature, is it really fair to say that Abrogato is an epic? Is it fair to say to apply the same genre that Homer uses to Virgil? Yeah, sure. But then when you get to something like Beowulf, I don't know. But I'm playing with those notions to see, you know, so if someone says, well, really, this is just a collection of poems. It's not one epic poem. I could understand why they'd say that, but I do try to use certain devices, like, for instance, Neymar appears throughout it as the hyped one. little tropes like that, little turns of phrases, boots on the ground, things like that, that run throughout it. And obviously the theme of the futsal gods runs throughout the text. And then, you know, and also the very epic device of singing to the muses and asking for them to come through you with, you know, whether it's Homer or Virgil or Hesiod and that notion of, you know, sing through me, muse, and through me, tell the tale of, you know, I was trying to take that seriously. And again, there's, you know, Schiller's term of the naive poet rather than sentimental poet. There's some sentimentality that creeps in here and there. There's bits of me, but I think where it works best is where it just kind of flows through. And, it was easier for me for it to flow through in my living room rather than the local pub.
Right. It's powerful, I think, because there's something, it captures this, you know, the strangeness of time during a World Cup where just the weird way it shifts, like, everyone's experience of time who's involved. But then I also, like, and this I see in the letters, too, that this sort of sadness and boredom inherent in the process, you know, which is the part that obviously the hype of media doesn't really deal with, right, in any way, right? Everything's supposed to be exciting. But, of course, the share of disappointments and sadness and boredom is significant, you know, in watching a World Cup. And I think it comes through in the poem. The only other thing I was thinking of was these Alistair Reid, you know, series, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but who wrote, you know, a thing about the World Cup every 4 years in the New Yorker for, I think, like 30 years, actually. And it's kind of the opposite of what you've written, which is it's like every 4 years he wrote this really giant piece on the New Yorker that was an account of the whole World Cup, really. And they're pretty powerful. The one from 1966, I think, is the first one where he wrote about, you know, the England he's from in London. But then he writes, they're all actually on the New Yorker site, and they're for teaching. For those of you, I mean, others of you may know this, but they're pretty wonderful for teaching too. But I just, as I was reading, I was thinking about like the opposite, which is these kind of strange things where the person writes every 4 years versus the micro of yours, which is, you know, every day, multiple games, you know, through a month. So.
Can you find it?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say it in terms of that time outside of time, the festival time of the World Cup, you know, after you get through that, you know, the intensity of the group stages, when all of a sudden you get a day off from a match,
It feels very weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that feeling when I was in South Africa. I was like, what are we? I don't even know what to do with myself, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing I was going to say is that I noticed on Twitter during the World Cup, this guy Siddhartha Mutter, who writes for Africa as a Country, like he wrote these little tweet poems in French about games.
Oh.
So there were, I think on social media, there was at least a few places I saw where they were very funny, usually pretty humorous, like wordplay. I remember he said that the Belges se sont effrités, which is like, you know, the Belgians kind of tired themselves out, but also were French fries, or, you know, like wordplays about these different things. So just to say, I think you're correct that there's probably a desire for poetry that your book will sort of, you know, that crystallizes in a way that wonderfully so. Anyway,
there was something I remember David Goldblatt, one of his dispatches from the tournament, he had said at some point, I've since tried to go back and find it, and I haven't, so maybe it wasn't David, but I thought it was, something to the effect of, you know, what poetry will there be from this World Cup or something.
I remember that too. I remember him seeing that, yeah, saying that.
I wanted to write David and say, I'm trying, but I wasn't sure if I'd just failed dismally or not, so I never bothered him, but hopefully he'll get the message.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we'd like to open it up maybe to two phone participants who I suspect are Brenda and Stephen, because they don't have a way to raise their hands. So are you both there, and would you like to ask David anything?
I'm here and listening, but just back from the dentist office, so can't really talk very well, but I loved the reading, and hi to everybody.
Great. Thanks, Brenda.
I hope you're feeling better. Soon. Brenda, I do want to just say that, you know, the title has something to do with you, really, in that, that the title really came to me at the Hofstra soccer conference when I got a hug from Pelé and he was saying obrigado. And I'd been struggling with, oh, what would a title be for this? What would a title be for this? And sometime during the World Cup, it was like, that's it. It's what he was saying there in Hempstead. So I don't know if you noticed, but you're acknowledged at the beginning of the book. And really, that's why.
Oh, I did. Obrigada. Obrigada por eso. It's interesting because it's a gendered way to say thank you in Portuguese, which is really interesting. I actually was going to ask about that, but literally, like, the anesthesia, I don't want to bite my cheek. But just to say, that was fascinating, and I think it's a great title.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, in terms of gender issues with this, I do want to at least acknowledge my daughter's frustration with me, and that I wasn't able to do this again the next year. She really felt like the same thing should have been done for the World Cup in Canada, and I agree with her, but I couldn't go through it again. I just couldn't do it. I may have even written a few lines about the final, I also think that a lot of this project, I guess the purpose behind it in some way, I don't like the word purpose for it, but just again, the idea of just this absolute concentration on it. So my household had the same concentration on the Women's World Cup, but the world didn't. And I think that might have been a factor as well. I know in terms of my personal energy, I just couldn't commit to it. So my way of compensating for that was by taking my daughter to the ticker tape parade. But I know whenever we talk about Obrigado and what we all went through and what the family had to go through because I was going through this, she's still a bit upset, feeling like, how could you do that for the men's, not the women's? I'm such a great World Cup dad. She's right.
Well, I'll jump in here and ask a question alongside one of Chris Brown's question, who he sent in via email because he wasn't able to join us today. But his first question was, who or what were the writers and writings that most inspired this work? You've already talked a little bit about that, but I wanted to ask maybe to direct your focus somewhere concrete about Galeano.
Galeano in particular, to me, there's a one of the repeating motifs really is this critique of Garacharua, mm-hmm. Sorry if I'm mutilating pronunciation. But, you know, a critique of your Uruguayan football. And as much as Galeano's Soccer and Sun and Shadows had a profound impact on me, and that book obviously is a tremendous influence, there's at least one poem where I'm addressing him directly. Mm-hmm. Kind of saying, you know, come on, how could it be that you've generated such a poetics of football, but this isn't living up to that at all? Galeano had a real big impact on me in that aphoristic style. Also, I would say another really important text for me, other than the obvious epic writers, Marshall's On the Spectacles, which was written when the Colosseum first opened in Rome. It's a rather gruesome representation of what occurred when the Colosseum was opened up. But the idea of a poet attending the event or representing the event in poetry, and Marshall really had a big impact on me. Pausanias, too. You know, some of the ancient figures, so they weren't dealing with sport and epic. They were dealing more with lyric. I don't know what you'd call On the Spectacles. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that really strange work by Marshall. He's mostly known as someone who would write epigrams. And that collection On the Spectacles really had a big, big impact on me and a big influence on this piece. Just trying to think. Yeah, also, you know, Brian Glanville's script for the '66 World Cup film, that had a pretty big impact on me, I think I'd have to say. And in the World Cup prior, I believe it was right before the broadcast of the final, there was some piece that was narrated by Terrence Stamp that was really beautiful. I don't know if any of you remember it, but it that left a really big impact on me 4 years prior. So I'm just trying to think of the different texts that were really big influences on this.
Yeah, I noticed Uruguay maybe is the most condemned team in that. Not that it wasn't justified in some ways, but I laughed when I saw you kind of calling out Galeano for the sins of Suarez and the general tactics of Tavares during the tournament.
Yeah, you know, it's just to me that there was a certain relationship between ethics and aesthetics that a lot of us feel. I mean, I didn't used to think that, you know, back when I was playing in the 70s and 80s as a striker, I didn't care how we played so long as they got the ball up to me. You know, that's all I care. I don't care. Take Route 1 soccer as long as I get the ball and I get a chance to score. That's all I care about. But my sense of aesthetics of the game really changed when Wenger came into Arsenal. And I really became someone more obsessed with Joba Benita and, you know, the idea of playing the game in a beautiful way. And there were a lot of disappointments in the tournament, right? I mean, who would ever think that Germany would play the best football of the tournament and that Brazil would be such a disappointment, that Spain would be such a disappointment? But I think there's what I would say is the futebol gods ethics, if you will. You know, so Jogo Benito would be damned. That's a phrase that recurs throughout it. And there are a lot of moments throughout where I wish I could speak with Galeano. That his voice is echoing inside of mine, and I wish the Uruguayan team read Soccer in Sun and Shadow.
Great. Let's invite Stephen to ask a question. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Alex. Great. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Still struggling with this application.
Can hear you loud and clear.
Excellent. I missed the beginning. Shame on me. I should have done my homework to play a little bit with it to figure out how to join properly. David, I really enjoyed your book, and I really love the metaphors that you use, Blitzkrieg. I'm looking currently at one of your bombs, United States versus Portugal, Manaus, and it ends up Bradley, Aldair, Nani, Ronaldo, Varela, Fini. Mm-hmm. Is it almost like at the end you're trying to kind of, it looks like passing the ball? Was it your intention to end up the poem that way?
Hi, Stephen. Yeah, I'm so glad you noticed that. Yeah, that's actually...
That's a formation.
Some of the poems really were more for performance and to be read, but that one in particular was an image poem where if you remember that sequence of passes... it corresponds pretty well on the page with the way the ball came down the pitch.
Absolutely.
The knee is where the goal would be.
And that was brilliant. It almost kind of, I don't know, it reminded me a little bit like the poet with Emily Dickinson. In one of the poems, she was kind of trying to recreate the fall of a leaf, and that kind of thing looked a little bit, I don't know, it made me think automatically of her.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Sure, or George Herbert or something. But yeah, it's a definite image. I'm glad you were able to pick that up. But yeah, Bradley gets stripped by Adair right in the middle of the field, who then leaves it off for Anani, who then, you know, swings it out to Ronaldo, back over to Varela, and then it's
Fini.
Yeah.
And I have a question, maybe a twofold question, David. I really enjoyed this. Do you intend to do a sequel, like maybe one that is titled, like maybe two more, one that is titled Spasibo in 2018, and another one in 2022, maybe titled Shukran?
I like the ideas of that. Like I said, my daughter condemns me for not doing this again the very next year, and she's right. I can't do it again. There's no way I could go through it, in all honesty. It was really... a lot. It took a lot out of me, and it took a lot out of my family. There was I think anybody that writes understands how the text you're writing becomes selfish in and of itself, and you've got to nurture this thing or else it'll die. And I can't do it again. But what I would like to see just next year would be maybe a poet from every country contributing a poem. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be neat if there was if there were two poems from each match with a poet from each country, or I can imagine different iterations of something like this where each match has a poem or two or more. And you get a whole bunch of different voices and different languages as well. It would be really nice to see poems in all of the countries that are playing in the World Cup. And to see that come through would be something that would be what I'd like to see in the future. I certainly can't do it again, but I'd like that if someone else took that up, or if other poets took it up and collaborated in that way.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That actually ties nicely to another question that Chris asked via email. He said, had you always planned on doing the match-by-match structure? Was that something that you arrived at during the writing process? He wonders if there are other ways that you might have considered taking us through the tournament, perhaps city by city?
Yeah, or even just, looking at one nation all the way through it, or a particular player. But yeah, the way it was conceived. Mm. The idea was to that the tournament itself is one large epic. I know, like I mentioned before, we'll use the adjective, oh, that was an epic match, for a really well-played match. The idea behind this all along was to be able to write a poem for each match. And that was, again, my big fear, in all honesty. I really didn't know if I'd be able to, after 64 matches, have 64 poems. And if I did, if would 64 of these poems be readable? I mean, that's the other kind of scare. That was a big fear of mine, was what if after 43 matches, there are none that I can write about? Is there nothing to write about? Some of these wrote themselves as the match was going on. The one Stephen just pointed out, literally the movement of the ball kind of finishes the poem itself. Whereas some others maybe took a day or two of reflection, sometimes frustration, like with the Greeks. I had some frustration with the Greek team in some of their matches, the Iranian team. There were a few duds in the tournament, right? But it, all in all, I think it was a pretty good tournament. But I think there are many different other ways of structuring a poem that would try to represent a World Cup tournament. But this was the idea for the project for a few years before. But I've been this had been in my mind for a few years before the tournament, kind of leading up to it. The World Cup prior in South Africa, I wrote a piece where I wanted to show how Aristotle's poetics could be used to explore a football match. And so I applied those constituent elements from the poetics to the Netherlands final, Netherlands-Spain final. So I'd kind of done something with artistic representation and the idea of football and aesthetics 4 years prior, but it got me thinking, well, what can I do this next World Cup? And again, as I was teaching these different texts, whether it was classical literature or the sport literature class, just the idea of like, wow, 64 games. Wouldn't that be great if the 64 games, if there was a work of art for every game, and that all of them come together as one work of art? That was the hope.
I'll turn it over to Peter, who's going to relay a message from the Twitter sphere.
Yes, this comes from Sean Stein, who says, on the language of others, I found the refrain Joga Bonito, or Be Damned, to be beautiful bilingual experimentation. Comment?
What's that?
Comment? Juxtaposition?
It's a linguistic high wire act, like I said before. And, in New York, at least, you're just hearing so many people speaking different languages all the time, and you're always just kind of playing with language. Again, those of you that know me know how much of a ridiculous extrovert I am, and I make myself look ridiculous all the time. So that's nothing new to me, and I think linguistically, it's just it's a way. And growing up playing soccer in America too has always been a very cosmopolitan experience. The team I grew up loving were named the Cosmos, after all, because of cosmopolitanism, and that those superstar teams in the 70s and 80s had so many different players speaking so many different languages in the locker room. So the idea of picking up language, not in a classroom sense at all, but off the pitch, is the way I think of soccer. I think of soccer and language. And 4 years before, with that World Cup at the of the constituent elements that Aristotle uses in poetics, the one element I thought trickiest to apply to soccer was lexis, or language. And I ended up thinking that through in terms of tactics. The tactics is the language of football. That when we talk about football, we talk about language. And when you're out on the pitch and you're I remember a game I played, must have been in 2001 with a team of Croatians. And they were just speaking Croatian the whole match. And the way hand gestures would fill me in terms of my tactical role. They stuck me on the wing, which was not a very good experience. But way too much running. Basically, they were telling me to run, you know. But so in terms of, that kind of silly bilingualism or whatever that tweet may reference, it's this... there's something ludic at stake, obviously, is the balls moving around. And people are speaking languages, and you're hearing these different phrases and the color of those words. You know, I know a lot of American soccer fans try to be very dismissive when you say something like, you know, football boots rather than wearing your cleats. And that kind of comes through even with a phrase like boots on the ground, where I'm playing in the on the notion of, you know, nationalism and imperialism and militarism, and you know, the idea of American boots being on the ground, but literally that these are also football boots on the ground. I think some people in other, you know, reading other languages are maybe not be used to that idiomatic expression that we use in terms of boots on the ground as a militaristic thing. And to me, even not, you know, my disgust for nationalism makes World Cup viewing a very guilty pleasure. So to me, to really be open to this experience of the World Cup is something that really unites the globe. It has to start with language, and you have to be willing to make mistakes and look silly with words. And I wasn't afraid to do that here. And that became another thing, too, when it went to the publication. I was really lucky to have Nathan McVitie take on the graphic design for the, you know, first the CD and then when the book came out. And he first read some of Abrogato. I was in London the week after the final, and I was really enthusiastic about this, and he was reading it, and he was really into it and encouraged me. So about 6 months later, when I got the recording contract before this actually came out as a spoken word album before it came out as a book. And I asked him if he'd be willing to do the graphic design. He was, by that point in time, doing graphic design for Leicester City. And as you well know, Leicester City were having a really great run of form in late 2014, early 2015. And I think he did a really great job. But again, it was... the idea of, and he was there in Brazil. That was to me another important thing, that the person doing the graphic design actually was there having fun in Brazil, where I was on my couch. Again, it was the idea of not being afraid to use other people's words and try to break out of, you know, the traps of just your language. But then he did the typesetting as well. And so when he did the first run through, a lot of the diacritical marks were different or removed. And that actually, and Brenda has pointed this out too in terms of gender and certain expressions, you know, whether it's abrigado or abrigada, things that right, are perhaps ignorance of those distinctions. By losing a diacritical mark on one of the Persian words in one of the Iranian poems, a friend of mine from Iran pointed out that the absence of a particular diacritical mark would have turned the phrase into a profound insult. And so, you know, we had to make sure that that when it went to print, that the diacritical marks were accurate. Hopefully they all are. Because even, you know, the absence of one diacritical mark or something that should look a certain shape, and if the diacritical mark is there but not exactly the right diacritical mark, it literally could have a very different intended effect. So I was trying to be really sensitive to those linguistic concerns, but also, you know, not nowhere near the kind of polyglot one needs to really you know, navigate these nuances of language without making a mistake.
David, you're a lot more courageous than I am. I would never try to do what you did, and partly because I'm a terrible poet, but also because, you know, you're willing to take these risks, these chances, and that's when great things happen. So congratulations for that.
Thank you.
I'm curious about how the history of football influenced your poetry, because this is as you said, you know, you were writing these poems before the match, or sometimes during the match, sometimes at halftime, or maybe immediately after the match, if I remember correctly. How did knowledge, your profound knowledge of the history and culture of the game, influence your reading of the game at the time that you were writing? That's my question for you.
Well, I think certainly as prep, I went back and watched all the FIFA World Cup films, the authorized films for all the World Cups that exist. Tried to really get a good sense of how the tournament flowed. That was something I was really trying to figure out. I know a lot of people are really disgusted at the idea of FIFA expanding the tournament, and I'll take a risk right now and say I'm one of the probably few people in the football world who actually welcomes more teams into the tournament. Just because of my sense of how the tournament itself has evolved from 1 4 years to another. I think it's going to actually improve the tournament, but I know it's not a popular opinion. But my sense of how each tournament had its own flow, I really wanted to get a sense of, I wanted you to be able to just, if someone was an Italian football fan and they only wanted to read the poems about the Italian national team, that they would be able to dip into this and get out of that and have some kind of connection. Hopefully a memory will be triggered somehow. And I was also playing on, in terms of history, I know this isn't football history, but I was really trying to play with notions of aletheia, or truth is an unfolding, or an unconcealment. So I'm hoping that there are certain moments that are kind of revealed or unconcealed. But I think you have to have a sense of how each tournament has its own flow and its own narrative. So in terms of football history too, I think the idea of national character being represented in the football team. So again, the sense of letdown by the Brazilians. I hope the opening poem the first matches poem conveys that sense of the burden of history that I felt Brazil had on their shoulders, and how just one act, one dive, just blows their legacy. And I knew from that moment on they were not going to be able to live up to their own national history and how Brazil should be performing in Brazil. You know, also, you know, a couple of books that really big influences for me in the lead up to it were Alex Belos's Futebol and David Goldblatt's Futebol Nation. Those books really impacted me a lot right going into the tournament, trying to understand the history of Brazilian football, trying to understand as best I could the history of each nation that was going to it. I would have preferred that this didn't come through, There is definitely probably an American perspective that does end up coming through anyway, with the poems of the U.S. national team. So there's that sense of having something to prove with it. And even when it gets to the last U.S. poem, if you will, against Belgium, the fact that in the first World Cup, the United States beat Belgium was very much on my mind and something that frustrated the heck out of me as people thought Tim Howard was such a great hero. For me, it had a feeling of, you know, people think we've come so far, but really we haven't, with an historical perspective. So, I think when you're watching the tournament, you know, the gold shirt of Brazil, the white shirt of Germany, the orange shirt of the Netherlands, and I think the game that they were most brilliant orange, they were wearing blue. I think I alluded to that in one of the poems. That sense of the colors and the shirts and them coming back and what they represent, the text itself is interwoven with all those other tournaments that have come before it. I know when you talk to players who've played in the World Cup, they're all fulfilling that lifelong dream of competing in it. And it's that dream that motivates them to get there in the first place. So they're all playing with that burden of history on their shoulders and what their place in history will be. So I think, hopefully, some kind of a knowledge base, going back to when I was a young soccer history obsessed kid, has kind of helped prepare me to be able to write it.
Great. Thank you, David.
Okay, we have some questions queued up. Let's go to Andrew, who hasn't asked one yet, and then we'll go back to Daniel, who has another question. Go ahead, Andrew.
Okay. Thanks. Like everybody else has said, this is a great project, super fun, and I'm sort of surprised to hear you say you could never think about doing it again, because it sounds like just sitting on the couch for a month and watching all the World Cup games and engaging with art around it sounds like a dream come true, but maybe that's the grass is greener on the other side kind of thing. But I guess my question, it actually does build a little bit on Peter's question, because it does, I don't know enough about poetry to understand the nuance, but at a content level, it does seem like a lot of the poems are so elegant in describing the games themselves and the teams themselves. But then I assume it was sort of a choice to not engage as much with the broader sort of social and political context of what's going on, even to the extent of some of the things around Brazil as the host and, as you know, investing so much money in the stadiums in Manaus that are never going to get used again, and some of those kinds of issues. So I'm just sort of curious the thought process around that. And then I think as a kind of related question, it also, like, part of what's fun about reading the poems is getting reminders of the magical moments, the spectacular goals and the controversial diving and the, you know, each of those moments. But then I was thinking as I was reading it, that's part of the fun of it, but it also risks almost sort of distilling the game down to a SportsCenter highlight, kind of like here's the two moments. So I was just curious, it just got me thinking about that. How would you navigate that? So I was curious how you navigated that as you were trying to write the poetry.
Thanks. It's kind of a two-pronged question, and I thank you so much for asking them, because, yeah, they're really, really, you kind of hit the nerve in a good way in that. I think the very first poem that was written for the opening match, there's that line, "Is the blood they smell in the stadium or the street?" You know, looking back on it, and certainly, you know, rereading it and re-listening to it in preparation for today, I was struck, I don't know if disappointment's too strong of a word, I expected this to be a lot more political. I just thought that going into the tournament, I thought I'd be talking a lot about things outside of the stadium. And I don't know that if I would have actually been there in Brazil that I would have been able to see or be more aware of it. But at a certain point, very early, those issues seemed to get pushed to the side, which is, of course, a a really big ethical problem. The issues of, you know, protesters and social inequity and the calamity of these stadiums and the impact they'll have on the people there and the lead up to the Olympics later on. I really thought a lot more of that would come through, and it didn't. There are some kind of implications here and there, but that wasn't as big of a theme as I expected it to be. And then the second prong to your question, can you kind of just rephrase that?
I guess it's just a thinking about the games themselves.
The idea of a kind of sports center. That was another ethical obligation, I think, in terms of, you know, to do this, you've got to watch every single minute of every single match. Which obviously, you know, when you get to the last match of each of the group round, there's overlap of the games. So you've got to choose which one to watch live, make sure you're recording the other one, and then spend the time watching that. Because if you just watch the highlights, there's something wrong. And I think some of the poems are like those kind of highlight reel things, right? It's the moment. Others of the poems are about the waiting for the moment and it never happens. And then others are just kind of a glance back at the whole, if you know what I mean. But one poem in particular where I'm talking about Messi isn't Argentine, he's not really Brazilian, he's not human, he just plays, something along those lines, and, you know, but do so many ants have to work in the dirt to let a flea fly, I think is the phrase. That was a match in particular where, again, you just feel like, is there any art in this match at all? Where's the art? It's just sheer utility, and that tension between just utility and art for art's sake, if you will, that they're wrestling with tactically on the pitch was something that became almost a problem for me too. I wanted to make sure that writing a poem wasn't just a matter of utility, that, oh, well, I've got to have a poem for this game now, so even if it's no good, I better at least do it. I didn't want it to be that way. I wanted each one of the poems to respond to some kind of necessity other than just, well, I've got to have 64 poems because there's 64 games, so I've got to write something for this one. I didn't want it to be that way. And fortunately, that wasn't the case. But with some of the games, it took a couple days before the poem really kind of came out that was worth, not well, that didn't get thrown out, you know? But yeah, I think, one could just focus on the highlights, but yeah, hopefully what comes through in this is all the minutes of all the games, or the full 90 minutes, taking in the whole flow of the game, rather than just like, oh, who scored? Dean Rader, who's a really great, great poet out of San Francisco, he actually was commissioned by the Golden State Warriors 2 years ago when they made the NBA Finals. He was commissioned to write a poem for them. And we used to be office mates at Binghamton many, many years ago. But when he read a draft of this before it was published, he recommended that I have a list of the goal scorers for each game so that each poem would at least, you'd know, oh, this match ended 2-1 and these people scored in these minutes, you know, to have those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But I ultimately resisted that suggestion because I thought that would narrow it down to just those kinds of things, that it would direct the reader just to that. So what I'm hoping too is that the reader of a particular poem will go back and look up those things rather than it being kind of just conveniently on the page. Or I even thought about, you know, an appendix that has had those statistics or something. That was something that Dean had suggested, but I didn't want it to be reduced to that. So I'm kind of hoping that every poem kind of captures the full event of the match rather than just the highlights. But yeah, certainly the memorable highlights do come through too. They're the moments that end up making you want to write. Although there are some moments there too where it's like you're waiting for the miracle and then it never happens.
I like the decision not to put the score lines on each of the poems. It did make me look up. I didn't look up all the matches, but I looked up the ones that that I had, you know, an unclear memory about, and then it made me realize a few things that you were talking about in the poem, or maybe you were left out of the poem or alluded to. I thought that was a good decision. Daniel also has another question.
Yeah, David, you could write a love poem on the enlarged World Cup, because some people say just because Infantino is married to a woman from Lebanon and Lebanon never qualified so far for a World Cup, he enlarged the World Cup to make it maybe possible that Lebanon will qualify one day.
Yeah.
But by the way, the enlarged World Cup will not have the problem anymore of matches at the same time. And that's a question I wanted to ask Holten, but now you answered it. How did you handle the last match day when the matches were at the same time? Because I was thinking maybe you watched like on two TVs both matches at the same time, or one half time each, but you already said a little bit about it.
Yeah, I tried the split screen thing. I think the first of the matches that overlapped, and about 5 minutes into it, it's impossible. Like, I wouldn't get a poem out of either match.
Yeah.
I quickly modified whatever to record the one and then just focus on the other. Because you couldn't be split. You couldn't be bifurcated between one match and the other. It would be that kind of ethical question we just got there, in terms of you'd be jumping back and forth from one highlight to the other if you're lucky, right? So instead, it was a frustration to me, that because I'd rather just watch them all live. So there was that handful of matches that I had to watch recorded just after the other.
I think it's the right decision, because I remember the 2010 World Cup, I had the objective to watch every match. And then at the last match day of the group stage, then I watched from both matches at the same time, like sometimes one half time, but I didn't enjoy that. You know,
yeah.
Because you need to be in a match and not like the changing is no fun.
Yeah. The flip side of that, of course, is you get into this terrible situation of trying to avoid all social media for another 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And you know, the don't tell me the result. Don't tell me this. You know, I haven't seen it all yet. You know, you kind of have to put yourself in a weird bubble to have that kind of pure engagement with the match. And of course, then too, you know, they're not necessarily quiet about what's happening in the other match, because they want to be able to say who won the group. You know?
How old are your children? I could not write with my small children at home a poem during watching football.
Well, my son is 16 and my daughter is 13, so I'd have to do the math and subtract back, but they're old enough to be appreciating it, and they were into every match.
Okay.
Any other questions lined up? Perhaps people who have not had a chance to ask one yet. I can read one last question from Chris. He sent via email, which you've already answered in some ways. He asks, how did you cope with the overwhelming 24/7 rolling coverage of the tournament as you settled down to write your own take on it? Did you lock yourself away from said coverage, or did you read everything before identifying your own foci? And he said, also on a personal note, he loved how you captured the sense that England could still be optimistic after Manaus.
I just threw myself into it absolutely and completely, immersed myself in it in every way, shape, or form that I possibly could. So I would read every single match report I could after every match. Mm. I just had the coverage going nonstop, no matter where I was at. I think one way of doing this would be to watch it with the sound off, right, or no commentary. I often wish that we could watch football and have the option to just have the ambient sound of the stadium and not have to listen to match commentary. I'm sure you all have certain commentators you'd rather not listen to during a match. that would be another way of doing it, I suppose, by not even having that kind of critical filter of play-by-play or color commentary. But no, I didn't. And I, in another way of doing this too, would be to not read any match reports, not get any opinions, not watch the post match reviews and things like that. And so, but I kind of have a notion of there's nothing outside of the text. So rather than kind of just closing off and trying to, you know, restrict things, I wanted to just immerse myself in this kind of highly mediated engagement tournament. That, you know, playing with these notions of distance, but also connectedness and being tuned into what's going on globally. I didn't take any time off from it in the month. It just completely took over my world. And I made sure that I set up my life that way too, you know, more than a year in advance. You know, when this comes up, this is what I'm going to try to do. My family knew that, embraced it, and allowed it. I guess in many ways, it would be almost like what a method actor has to do. A friend of mine is friends with Daniel Day-Lewis, and he says that to be around him when he's in a role is really freaky. Not to compare myself to that or anything, but just in terms of the absolute immersion and the no escape from it. I mean, yeah, I understand why it sounds fun to be watching all of the 64 games and to be writing about it. It really took over my life. Really took over my life. And my wife was talking this morning about how there was a certain stress level with that. It was fun, but it was also like trying to perform. I wasn't just sitting back and being passive. There's a performative element to it. And, you know, I couldn't just take a game off and drink some beers and just enjoy it in a different kind of passive way. Instead, it was a kind of psychological commitment to the match, to perform with it as well. That the final match was so euphoric, I just never went to sleep that night. I just saw the sunrise after the final. And the very first opening poem, Fuchibologia, that was written in the wee hours after the final, just in that sense of euphoria. So it's kind of like a manifesto or kind of an explanation of what I'm trying to do. Probably terribly pretentious to some readers, I'm sure. But again, I'm just being silly too. I'm having fun. It's playful. But that was written in the euphoria of, you know, there's no way I can go to sleep. What a month this has been. But then, you know, a full day later, I finally slept, and I can't imagine doing it again. It was a hell of a good month.
Yeah, you received congratulations from everyone else, and I might as well toss my two cents in. I really enjoyed reading it. I was definitely transported back to Buenos Aires, and I, you know, was reminded of a lot of the something that I didn't pick up on directly in the Argentina poems, which I'm not sure what the coverage was like here, the kinds of punditry that you were consuming, but Argentines were shocked to be in the final, and almost at certain points a little embarrassed by some of the results. And I agreed with a lot of the analysis that I saw in Argentina that you know, the team was really at moments very close to getting the results that they deserved, really. Which came closest in the Swiss match, which you did capture really brilliantly. I had a very clear image in my mind from reading it. But there was a real explosion of euphoria at the semifinal against the Dutch. And yeah, reading the book reading the poetry was a real pleasure, because it took me back to being in the subways of Buenos Aires, going to the Obelisco, and I thought the train that we were in was going to burst at the seams because everyone was banging on the roof and sides of it. So the evocative power of the poetry was it's something that I don't experience much, because I don't consume much poetry, but I really enjoyed it. So thanks for that.
Oh gosh, thank you. Well, again, that's kind of my hope with this too, is that people who read poetry but don't know much about soccer, that they'll still enjoy this in some way, and also that people who love football but don't read much poetry will you know, enjoy some poetry with this. That's really the hope. But yeah, in terms of Argentina, I just I think Abrigado is pretty tough on Argentina, and there is a sense at the end, again, you know, in terms of Higuain's early miss or Velasco's later miss, the idea of just feeling like the gods weren't going to let it happen. Mm-hmm. The idea that for Argentina to win in Brazil would be probably too much for the Brazilian nation to handle. And that it just wouldn't have been deserving either. And the sense of Messi's artistry just strung out to its absolute limit. Mm-hmm. So it really was, you know, the notion of, okay, Messi is the flea, but the rest of the team being these worker ants. That's the way I kind of processed what was happening with that Argentina team. It really, really frustrated me the way they were grinding out those results, just getting enough to get by and get to the final. And again, I think, to think about the earlier question about the history of the World Cup, for the Germans to be so un-German in their approach. I mean, we had seen this before in this transformation of the Mannschaft as playing a very different type of football from, and I also think Germany get a really harsh critique, you know, in terms of the 74 World Cup. I mean, one of my idols as a kid, Franz Beckenbauer, the most elegant midfielder you'll ever see. So, but in terms of this tension between utility and artistry and the feeling that Argentina just wasn't artistic enough, they just, you know, had they won the tournament, it would have been a real, well, I just think the football gods didn't allow it.
Okay, David, I have to go to a meeting, but I just got an email from Alon, who has a series of questions, some of which you already addressed, so this will be my parting shot, shall we say. Question that he asked that I don't think we've tackled yet. He says, I did not see any mention in the work of the wise and honest leaders of FIFA or of such righteous individuals as Sepp Blatter. Were you tempted to insert them into the games? Okay. Hold on. And then he's got another one. He says, Kobe Bryant announced his retirement in a poem. Are there any contemporary football players who write poetry? Thank you, Alon. And with that, I'm also going to take leave.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Thanks. By way to Alon. I think I was surprised at the fact that there wasn't more critique coming through in terms of FIFA and just the sense of corruption and exploitation and all those things, whether it was Brazilian politics or any of the other many different ideological concerns that really all of it should be thinking about. I'm a bit surprised that it wasn't more critical in some ways. But that wasn't a conscious decision. It wasn't that I said, well, I don't need this to be critical of FIFA. But there is a naivete behind this, not to sound like Candide and think that this is the best of all possible worlds, but the idea of the world coming together around this tournament, it's a really good thing for the planet. Look, there's a lot of bad that comes with this. There's no question about it. But there's something really beautiful about us all focusing for 90 minutes on the same ball. There's something really, really beautiful about that concentration of human consciousness at one time that really inspired the work and I hope comes through. So maybe that optimism kind of covers up, not to sound like Dr. Pangloss from Candide, but there is a sense of optimism probably also that comes through it that maybe even surprised me. I think I probably expected more pessimism, whereas the pessimism ends up being tactical, right? It's not the pessimism is, maybe, or cynicism is over, or the disgust with cynical tactics, or you know, whether it's a dive or a foul or just bunkering in. There is so much critique of that, whereas there's no real critique of the corporate excesses that go into the tournament. I think that's a fair criticism of Abrogato that I would have expected there to have been more of it in the poem when I entered into it. I think you see maybe a hint of it in the very first poem, but it doesn't really appear too much throughout the rest. Mm-hmm.
Andrew, you have another question?
Yeah, I think maybe it follows a little bit on that question about whether there's other footballers that write poetry. But I'm curious, you mentioned earlier teaching a class on sports literature. I might have to take that class to know the answer to this. But it does strike me from an outsider's perspective that there is probably less, like, as you said, people haven't done this. So this, like a lot of poetry around the World Cup, aside from possibly Galliano, if you phrase that as poetry, there's not a lot of good poetry about soccer, right? Would that be fair? And if that's fair, my question is sort of why, particularly in the context of my sense, I always enjoy like the art around even the FIFA official kind of art around the World Cup. I think they do interesting stuff where they get interesting artists to produce or to reproduce works that they associate with the host country and affiliate with the World Cup. And that seems like for an artistic endeavor associated with the World Cup, it seems relatively robust to me. And there's also, of course, these days, lots of great long-form essay writing around the World Cup, those kinds of things. So I'm curious if I'm right, why do you think there might be less sort of poetic engagement around the World Cup than some of these other art forms?
You know, great question. I think that in terms of artistic expression in World Cups, certainly for me in 1982, that was my first Panini book. Panini stickers are for me a really important way of connecting with the World Cup. And the 82 one was the first one where I had, you know, 1982 when I came across the Panini book. It was the first time I'd heard of it. And so I got really taken in by the posters for each tournament city. You know, this is the first time I'd heard of those cities in Spain. For me, prior to 82, you know, my thoughts of Spain were mostly of Franco. And so the World Cup tournament in 82 just completely opened up my mind to Spain. And, you know, Juan Miró in particular, this is the first time I'd ever heard of Miró. And, so those posters really opened up. And for me, more than anything with that tournament, I think of Miró more than I do Rossi with the 82 tournament. And there's a lot of great visual art. And I think, as a kid, I would see at Cosmos games, there would be Leroy Neiman would be painting by the touchline, which was kind of part of the fun of going to Giant Stadium. You'd see this famous painter literally making a painting as they were playing, just yards away from the pitch. But in terms of verbal expression, I think you're right. I think there's something about football culture globally. Again, I don't mean to offend anybody with this, but the idea of, yeah, Kobe Bryant pens his retirement announcement in a poem or something, that's a real anomaly. And most athletes aren't really wordy types, right? That tends to be the exception. Again, I know Franz Beckenbauer would be bunkered away in his hotel room reading all the time, but that's a pretty big exception, the idea of the athlete as voracious reader. And even though a lot of the talking heads that we have as commentators on matches, there is a sense of, the idea of the footballer as a talker. It's, you know, they're more people of action than people of words. I mean, that's a terrible stereotype, but I think it kind of holds a little bit. I think in terms of writing on football, I mentioned this earlier, George Plimpton had this theory that the smaller the ball, the better the writing. There's a long, long tradition of writing poetry about baseball here in the United States. I'm a member of the Sport Literature Association, and there's a tremendous body of scholarship on poetry of baseball. So that's something that's been around since the late 19th century here in the United States. Writing poems on baseball. But in terms of poetry on soccer, I think soccer and literature really, for me, Fever Pitch, and the Fever Pitch came out of that whole zine scene the idea of it's, you know, let's start writing about this game we love. You know, we like to write. Well, I don't know if liking to write is the right thing to say. I don't think anybody that's really a writer really enjoys writing, do we? It's painful. But the idea that the game inspires so much ought to inspire the highest art forms. And I'm not claiming that with Abrogato in any way, shape, or form, but that's the aspiration to say that soccer is epic, and soccer deserves its epic poetry, is my way of trying to reconcile that problem. That, you know, as you say, anybody's ever done this. That kept being the thing for, you know, a couple of years before the tournament, in the lead up to the tournament in Brazil. Like, I don't think anybody's ever done this. If they have, we don't know about it, so I may as well do it. And if I fail with it, maybe somebody else will come along and do it a lot better. And so I'm hoping that more and more poets will write about soccer, and I'm hoping more and more footballers and people who love football will write poetry about it.
Are there any final questions as we approach 4 o'clock here? Any final questions would keep me from returning to my existence of pain as I am currently doing my revisions. So as you were talking, David, I said, I don't think anybody likes it. I think it's just pain.
Well, I do also
after the fact, maybe.
I mentioned Alan and John and Tom's collection, The Global Game.
It was our first book.
Yeah, that's a really great collection.
Mm-hmm.
It was published in 2008. And that shows that, you know, there's some really great poetry that's been out there on soccer. We just, for whatever reason, it hasn't really made it into the literary canon. But I, you know, who knows what is going to change in terms of the world of literature and its engagement with sport. I think, you're seeing more people writing on sport in literature from a critical perspective. And I think you're seeing, you know, certainly since Hornby, more up-and-coming writers willing to address sport more overtly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should. It makes me think of David Wood's recent book. He just had his book released on football and literature in South America. So maybe something that hopefully moves into paperback could become accessible for us to discuss. But it really engages with a pretty huge corpus of writing in Portuguese and Spanish about the game.
That's great.
Well, I haven't seen anyone queued up. So, David, do you have any final thoughts on Obrigado?
Just that, I'm really grateful, that everyone took the time to read or listen to these poems. In many ways, the Football Scholars Forum, I would have to say, kind of encouraged me to try to do this kind of a thing. I try to out football in a variety of genres, and this was something that I at least was going to try for myself, and then if I thought it was decent enough, then I'd be willing to share it with the world. It's just really really gratifying to discuss it with this group. I'm really very grateful.
No, thank you, David, for sharing your work with us, and I'm very glad that our continued getting together and chatting can have afterlives even in small ways in everybody's work. It's the spirit of the group. So thanks for sharing your work with us.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
All right, take care, all.